This is a YUN interview with Ms. Raymond Martineau concerning Namibia, made in Geneva on July the 7th, 1998. The interviewer is Sutherland. So, Ms. Martineau, I want first of all to thank you for participating in this Yale Oral History Project, and I'd like to talk with you today for this purpose about your experiences as a member of the UN staff in Namibia during the period of the transition to independence there. And I'd like, if I could, to begin by asking you, where did you come from? What were your duties? You were part of the UN staff before you went to Namibia.
Yes.
And what were your duties?
I was in charge, as I am still now, I was in charge of relations with non-governmental organizations at the United Nations office in Geneva. Mm-hmm. I had been in the UN for 13 years when I went to Namibia.
And how were you selected? Were you a volunteer, or did they knock on your shoulder, so to speak?
I was a volunteer. I gave my name, saying that I was available, but I wasn't at all expecting to be chosen. Mm-hmm. And I was very happy when it happened.
Why were you not expected to be chosen?
Well, you see, I thought that in any case, you give your name, and then if you don't have anybody to push you, you see, and the choice is made in New York.
Right.
So I thought, you know, I cannot have too much hope. And that's why I was a little bit surprised. But I know that one of the reasons why probably I was chosen is that they had, you know, decided that they wanted a certain number of women in this mission, and I think it did help. And I think here some people gave names of a certain number of women who had volunteered here. Mm-hmm. So I think that was the reason.
And why did you volunteer? Why did you want to go?
Well, I felt that after 13 years having been in Geneva, knowing the, you know, central office experience of the UN, I felt the need to go in the field and to see a different type of reality. And on another hand, I felt also it's also the duty of UN staff to be available for missions to go out of headquarters or offices in Geneva or Vienna to go in the field.
And did you know much about the program in Namibia? Did you know what the background was?
I knew a bit of the background because before being in the UN, I was working for an NGO who was dealing with problems of racism. And I had been involved myself in 1974 as an NGO representative here in Geneva in the organization of international conference, an NGO international conference on apartheid, decolonization, and so on. And I had learned a lot through that, meeting people from South Africa, Namibia, and so on. And so I remained interested by the region, although I was not an expert. I had never worked in the UN in that field, but I knew a bit of the background.
And what kind of orientation did you have, if any, or any kind of training before you actually went to Namibia?
Well, there was here a 2-day training. They discovered my name after the first day. All of a sudden, they realized they'd forgotten to invite me to the training. So I went to the second day of training. It was useful, especially if I compare with other missions where there was absolutely no training. It was useful to get, you know, some type of information about the whole situation in the country. They gave us some documents which I read. But the training was really quite, you know, limited. I would have liked to have, you know, a little bit more.
And did you know before you left here what your duties were going to be?
No, I had no idea. I knew where I would be posted.
You did?
Yeah, that I was probably one of the exceptions.
Yeah.
By accident, having been in touch with New York, with the person who was going to be the regional director, she told me that I would be posted in Caribbean. And I hurried to try to get a card of Namibia to see where, you know, Caribbean was.
Yeah.
So I knew where I would be posted, but what exactly my function would be, well, you know, in general, I knew there would be, you know, an election and we would monitor the whole process.
Where is Caribbean, by the way?
Caribbean is halfway between Windhoek and Swakopmund, in the central part of the country. Here.
There.
Right here. Near the Namib Desert. Not far from Walvis Bay.
Not far from Walvis Bay.
Well, yeah.
So when you got there, presumably you were in Windhoek for a while. Was there further orientation there?
I was in Windhoek for a few days. Most of the time we were just running from one administrative office to the other to get this and that. And the colleague who was assigned with me arrived a few days after. And so before he came, I tried to do as much as possible. When he came, we finalized the arrangement and we left. We took the car and then we left for Caribbean.
And what was Caribbean like? What were your conditions there?
Caribbean is a small, very small town, although in Namibia it's considered as a city. About 2,500 people with the township. It's it's a mining town. It's right on the main road from Windhoek to Swakopmund. The community is composed on black side of the population, so we have to speak in black and white, of Herero and Damara, mainly some Nama, Ovambo workers coming from the north. And on the white side of the spectrum, both Afrikaners and German, quite a strong German, origin, of people of German origin.
Germans who had been there from the time of Southwest Africa.
Yes.
Right.
There were some there who had been three generations born in Namibia. Others who came more recently, you know, in the 1960s, 70s. So you had different types of German population.
And what did you discover that your duties were? What was your work? How would you describe it?
Naturally, the first part, we arrived the beginning of May, first days of May. The registration was to begin 1st of July or 3rd of July.
Right.
So then we had 2 months to settle down. So the first thing was to settle down and get, you know, all the equipment and so on in the office. And there's always some problems.
But you did find an office.
Yes, we had an office already assigned to us when we arrived. But since the UN had not paid the rent, the owner refused to give us the keys. So we had to work out of the hotel. And after a while, finally, when he found the money on his account, then we were given the key. We had a very nice office, I must say, you know, a whole house to ourselves. After and then in settling down, we started to visit the area to know, you know, the different parts, and especially to meet with various authorities, population. And to start preparing for the registration process. The law had not been adopted yet. It was adopted quite late, the registration law. But we had to make preparation, even from the logistic point of view, for the registration. So these 2 months went, you know, very, very fast, because we didn't know anything. We had to learn Yeah, everything.
And how did you get to know the different communities, the German, the South African, and the blacks?
Well, we went to meet, mm-hmm. to meet them. We, with my colleague, you know, we took the car and we made appointments with the mayor, with the town clerk, with the religious authorities in Karibib, in Ojibwe. And we went to see all these people. When it was possible, we announced ourselves, and not, we just arrived and we introduced ourselves and we asked to meet, you know, people, the chief, and these people gave us names of other people that would be important to meet.
And how were you received as a, I mean, you were clearly identified as UN, right?
Yes, that was clear when we arrived at the hotel. Everybody were looking at us and they were very anxious to see who would come. Mm-hmm. One of the things they wanted to know was our nationality, mm-hmm. right away, to be able, in their mind, to situate us politically, especially the white mm-hmm. population, but not only. And since my colleague and I came from countries which were at different extreme of the political spectrum, mm-hmm. It was interesting to see the reaction of the population. It's clear that at the beginning, the white population, you know, looked at us with you know, mistrust. They really, in their idea, for many people, the UN was there to make sure that the SWAPO would win the election.
And that was true in your area too.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
What, by the way, is your nationality?
I'm Canadian.
You're Canadian.
Yeah.
And your colleague?
From Kazakhstan.
From where?
Kazakhstan.
Ah, Kazakhstan.
Kazakhstan, yeah. Mm-hmm. So naturally it was still the Soviet Union at that time,
no? It was still the Soviet Union, right?
Yeah, yeah. And it's clear that for the people there with this anti-communism among the white population, well, on the other side, the SWAPO, when they heard that my colleague was from Kazakhstan, they find, oh, this is great, brother, you know.
Yeah.
It was as embarrassing as, I found that was a very good thing to assign people, you know, who come from different political spectrum, although we were both civil servant of the UN and even our political ideas were not that different from one to the other. But for the perception of people, you see.
Was your colleague male or female?
Male.
Male. So you had the spectrum, but also sexual. So this is
yes, male. That also was important.
Right.
And then we had the police monitors who arrived maybe a week after we did, from Fiji. Mm-hmm. So that was actually an excitement in Caribbean because mm-hmm. I think people have never seen Fijian in their life. Mm-hmm. And these Fijians naturally were black, but at the same time, you know, from different types of origin, mm-hmm. they were very friendly, playing music and so on, and then it created some type of atmosphere.
Well, I want to ask you about that in a minute, but what difference did it make that you were female? Any?
I've talked quite a lot about that aspect. I believe that it was very important to have a mission where you had not just a few token women, but among the civilians, mm-hmm. at least a good proportion of women. It did make a difference from different points of view. First, naturally, when we arrive, it's clear that in a country which is very patriarchal, it's... people at first, especially, you know, these, you know, Africana and so on, and looked at you, what these women are doing here. At first, they don't take you very seriously. So you have to slowly, you know, make your point, and they can see that you are, as your colleague, you know, a civil servant of the UN, you're coming for a mission. Then it became quite important in the relation with the population. And I think for the women in Namibia, it was good. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Because for them to see, there are women who are in position, and even our regional director was a woman. The regional director was based in Swakopmund. And there were several district officers who were women. Mm-hmm. And I think it did make a difference for the population, for the women in the country, but also inside the mission. The fact that we have different approach, and I found that very, very positive.
Now, you come from an NGO background. Mm-hmm. Were there any indigenous NGOs there or external NGOs active?
Well, there were some, but actually few. Namibia is a country where the civil society, especially the NGO aspect, is not very, very strong, apart from the Lutheran Church. Mm-hmm. And most of the relation that I had, which I could consider, NGO, were through the Lutheran Church. We had a lot of contact with Lutheran Church. I became, quite close, I mean, not a friendship at first, because, we had to be very careful with two pastors, I mean, even a woman pastor. There were two women pastors in Namibia. One of them was in the Ojibwe, with her husband was a pastor also, and they were both, active supporters of SWAPO. So at first I was, a little bit careful, but they were very active also in social work and things like that. So I learned a lot of things. There were some, international NGOs, but mostly based in Windhoek. Mm-hmm. Once in a while we did receive visit from some of these people, but if I compared with South Africa, where I've been also on mission, there in South Africa you have a very strong civil society, a lot of NGOs, but in Namibia, not as many. I think it is now improving. Mm-hmm. It's clear, but it was not very strong because I looked for them myself, and really remained mostly in contact with the Lutheran Church.
And at the church, did you actually attend services, meetings that would be held in the church for the population?
Yes, we did have different types of meetings with the population, organized by the church, organized also on farms by farmers, because we had quite good relationship with the farmer community. At first they really looked at us, but then we became quite with good contacts with them, and they organized meetings. Mm-hmm. With very reluctant farmers. With us, I have the advantage that I speak German, so mm-hmm. that facilitated also. And the secretary was with us, who was from Geneva, also spoke also German. So we and my colleague, who was gifted for languages, he learned quite a lot of Afrikaans, and we managed to speak with a lot of this population, and even with. People from the black population, because English was not a very strong language in Namibia, although it's the official language today. It was either, Damara, Nama, Herero, Vambo, or Afrikaans and German. And even black people spoke German. Mm-hmm. I had a cleaning lady, and I spoke German with her because. I didn't speak, Damara. Mm-hmm. So it did help.
So communication then was relatively easy.
Yeah, it was not too difficult. At first it was really to gain the confidence of mm-hmm. the people and to show that we were neutral. The town was very small, and mm-hmm. after a while everybody knew us. Mm-hmm. And but we didn't have big problem. There was no violence in our area. Mm-hmm. Practically. Mm-hmm. We didn't have the problems that they had in the north, so it was very, very peaceful. There were tensions naturally among political parties and accusation of all types of things. Mm-hmm. And sometimes somebody complaining that something had happened, and when you went, it was not as dramatic as it seemed. But communication was not too difficult. For me, the most difficult aspect was the one that we spoke none of the languages of the black population. Mm-hmm. Although practically everybody spoke Afrikaans, but we didn't speak, my colleague a bit more, but it was a, the, you could speak with, you know, the people who were the leader who spoke English, and I felt sometimes the limitation there, that you could not really talk really deeply with the people.
And how extensive in this area was literacy? How much was that a problem?
It was a problem. Yeah. So certainly among the black population, not so. Yeah, especially about the older people in the township. There were schools, so the kids would go to school and so on. So it was not as strong. But when you went on the farms,
right,
there you found a lot of illiterate people.
And was it more prevalent among the women than the men, or could you make a distinction?
We didn't make any statistics on that. I think on the farms, I don't think it was much difference, but probably when you got to the townships, then you could see more difference between men and women. Yeah.
It's very interesting that the police, the CIVPOL, was from Fiji. I think there were three contingents, as I understand it. There was the political office, so to speak, and then there was the military, the peacekeeping, and then there was the police. You all worked together. Did that work well?
Well, we didn't have the military in Caribbean. They were based in Okahandja, and they would come once in a while to see everything okay, you know, and since there was never any particular problem in Caribbean, so they went on. So we didn't really live and work closely with the military, although they, you know, actually were present. I think the ones we saw most often were the Canadians, because they were in charge of logistics, and then they would, you know, come, and since we were on the main road, you know, everybody would stop at least maybe to go to the toilet and so on.
Right.
So we saw quite a lot of people, and the Canadians would always stop when we were on the way somewhere, even if they didn't have anything for Caribbean. And then the Kenyan would come at first. They didn't come there, and when we went close to the election, they came regularly asking questions, you know, if there'd been any incident, and how is it in relation with political parties, and, you know, and since there was no problem, they left. But we worked very closely with the police monitors, at first the Fijian only, then when we came closer to the election, we got two new contingents, we got 10 Ghanaian police monitors and 5 Canadian. So we had 20 police monitors for the period, you know, prior to the election and the election. And I literally lived with the police monitors because the accommodation was such that it was very limited, difficult to find accommodation. And I ended up in a school, in a boarding school, German boarding school, which was closed at that time. And we rented space, and then I was living in the middle of all the police monitors.
You were safe then.
Yes, exactly. I was safe.
In other places, the so-called CIVPOL in Cambodia and other and Islamics has been in many ways the most difficult and unsuccessful of the contingents. But you found that it worked well in Namibia, that is the...
Well, hey, I can speak only for Caribbean.
Yeah.
I know that in certain areas there were problems. One of them was a problem of communication. There were police monitors from certain countries who didn't speak English. Naturally, they didn't speak Afrikaans. And then you had some civilians who didn't speak French. These people spoke French, or some spoke Arabic or other languages, and it was the communication was a bit difficult. And sometimes there were also some tensions between civilians. We had that at the very beginning of the mission in Caribbean, because, and I know there is a question, you're talking about the chain of command. It was not clear at the beginning who was really the chief of the district.
Right.
So my colleague thought that he was the chief of the district, and consequently he was also the chief of the police monitors. But the commandant of the Fijian police had another idea, that he reported to his Fijian commandant, who was in Vindo, And then through the superintendent, I forgot his the title, it was somebody from Ireland, it was the chief of the whole police in Namibia. So he saw this chain of command there, but he didn't see any. So at one point there was a little conflict, nothing very serious, yeah, about the nameplate, which should be, you know, the front of the, right, of the building.
Right.
But then that was solved very rapidly, and then we found some compromise and, you know, accommodation. But I must honestly say that with all the police monitors that were there, we never really had serious problems.
And they didn't have problems with the local police?
No. At first, it was the same thing. The local police, you know, they would say, oh, they are here to report on us, and so they were very uneasy and even aggressive at first. But then after a while, because the Fijians, you know, they, I mean, they're so nice and everybody liked them, you know, and they play music and everything, and their character. Then they became friendly with the local police, and the local police would never go anywhere without coming first or calling and say, oh, we've been called to the township or to, I don't know, a farm where something happened. And they would always call the police, and they would go, and they even played football with them, you know, and things like that. So the relationship very rapidly were good. Naturally, sometimes there were some, you know, conflicting views over an incident.
Yeah.
But since we never had really serious political incident, it was mostly, you know, somebody was drunk and beaten another guy, and you know, this type of normal incident which happened in society. There was a lot of rumors about all types of things which actually didn't happen. So that certainly helped. It had been a very strong political tension, and like in South Africa, for example, that is a little bit, you know, more difficult. But in our area, I think the police realized after a while that it was to their advantage to make sure to have somebody from St. Paul.
Right.
Yeah, because then after that they could not be blamed, you know, for for anything.
What was your impression of Swapol?
It's difficult to say, because at first, okay, they were mistrust, you know, there was a mistrust between us, and for me also, maybe there was some type of maybe prejudice, but it's clear that Swapol had been involved in all types of things. It's clear, so you had to be careful, they could be very nice, you know, and then so on, what was behind. But with the time, I thought in Caribbean that they did a very decent job. If I compare again with what I have seen in South Africa with the police, where, I mean, there was very clear, I think what happened with the time in Namibia is that people, everybody saw that it was inevitable. I mean, the end was coming, and as the closer we were getting to the election, the more people became maybe accustomed to the idea that, okay, there will be election, and then Swapo will win, and after that it will be independence. So they were afraid, naturally, of what would happen after. And then I think a lot of people thought that they better, you know, behave well in a way. The more we got, the closer we got to the election,
yeah,
I think the more people in the police, you know, the mayor and so on, in a way, you better be on the right side of the fence when the time comes.
And the UN was on the right side of the fence?
Well, at first, you see, they thought we were on that side of the fence.
Down,
yeah,
the Swapo side, right?
Yeah, but then with the time, they changed their attitude, because they realized, I think that was quite general, but I can speak for Caribbean, they realized actually, as individuals, we were there to do a job. We were also bound by the same, you know, electoral law and so on. And then we got acquainted with the our South African partners, or Namibian or Southwest African, especially, you know, both of us, Aida and myself, we stayed the whole time, we stayed 11 months in the same place. Uh-huh. And we had the same partners for the registration and the election. Uh-huh. And I think, and we realized the same thing with them, because also sometimes we had some, you know, thoughts, okay, they are hired by South African administration, we better watch. Uh-huh. You know, and we don't know, and we didn't feel as secure at the registration. The election was much easier than the registration. Uh-huh. Because the registration, first of all, we were not very well prepared. The registration law came very late. There were some changes. In my case, I was not supposed to be involved directly in the registration. I was supposed to stay in the office and manage the office while Aida would be involved in registration. At the last minute, they said no, and they put me on a mobile team. And so there you are with someone, you know, who's very serious, and then he knows the whole region. He knows, you know, the languages, and you don't know. So you don't feel secure, and he doesn't feel secure either. Uh-huh. First of all, first to have a woman, and it was a bit difficult for him at first to accept that also. But then by the time the election came, we were much better prepared, and even he admitted that he said, I think you are much better prepared than we had been on the South African side, because the opposite of us. But by the time the election came, we had confidence in each other. Uh-huh. I knew that he wasn't there to try to win the election or try to, and he knew I wasn't there to make sure that, you know, Swapo would get the votes. Uh-huh. So we were much more relaxed at the election.
But his chain of command was to the South African.
Yeah.
What do they call it, Administrator General or something?
Yeah, we had like two teams, you see. Mm-hmm. He was the head of a team, I was of a South African team, I was the head of the other team. And then, like, we were doubling them in a way, like watching them. So a UN person behind every one of his team, you see, watching, you know, everything's done okay. And when there was a doubt or some questions that we had to discuss, and what do we decide on, do we refer that higher and this type of thing.
What was he called? What was his title, so to speak?
How did they, what were they called? You're asking me a question now. In his function, you know, originally, he was the administrator of Ojibwe, which was an agglomeration about 60 kilometers from Caribbean. And then, when it was an election, I think it was something like registration, head of a registration team or something like that. I can't remember the
title. But his chain of command was to the South African in charge in Windhoek. Right?
Yes, that's it. You had the same thing. For example, you had, okay, we had each team, so the two of us were the head. Then there was a regional structure where you had a UN person, supervisor or something like that. It was, I think, regional supervisor, somebody from the UN, and a guy from the South African administration. Uh-huh. And then after that, it went, I think, to the whole area, and then it went to Windhoek. Uh-huh. And each time, at each level, you had the two. Uh-huh. And if the problem, you know, could not be solved among Mr. Gerdes and myself, then it went up to you know, the two other guys in the district, and then it went to the region, and then it went to Windhoek.
Now, were the various political parties active there, SWAPO, but the other parties as well?
Yes, the electoral campaign began quite late. There were two parties who were ready and had prepared themselves, with SWAPO and the DTA. Mm-hmm. The other parties either were very weak or had been created quite recently, so they became active only, you know, a few weeks or months before the election, really active. So the battle was between DTA and SWAPO, and the two were strong in our area.
Did Njoba come there?
No, I don't think he might have come to Ojibwe at one point, but I don't remember that he came to Caribbean.
But he was the known figure.
Oh, yeah, sure, sure. Mm-hmm. And that was an interesting thing also. I'm thinking about that, the press, the role, the evolution of the press in the country towards the various parties, but especially towards the leadership of the SWAPO. Mm-hmm.
Did you have any role as the UN representative in trying to bring about some amelioration of relations between the various groups in society? Did you bring them together at all?
Well, the political parties, we did. We had meetings organized to discuss the code of conduct and discuss, the various issues. One of the issues in our area was the question of posters. Mm-hmm. So everybody complaining that Party X had taken away their posters to put their posters and this type of thing. So we had meetings with the political parties to bring the population together. That was not an easy thing to do because, for example, we had some translators. And we had one who was a teacher, a very brilliant young man who was a teacher in the area, and we hired him as an interpreter. And so one evening, my colleague and I, we invited him to have dinner with us in the hotel, so we went there. It was the first time that he was, going into this hotel, which before was reserved for white, but we felt that he was not at all comfortable, you see. And there were some barriers which were very difficult, especially for a foreigner to say, well, that doesn't exist anymore. And then we'll organize, parties and bring the blacks and whites together and so on. It was not as easy. In the church, for example, the only church where there were services on Sunday was in the township. The Lutheran Church had a service every Sunday. I went to, because I'm practicing, I'm Catholic, but there was no Catholic service, so I went to the Lutheran service, and I was always the only white person in the church.
And that's where they had a woman pastor?
No, the woman pastor was 60 kilometers away. Uh-huh. And even there, they had no pastors in the parish. It's the lay people who organized the whole thing, men and women together. It was quite interesting. I didn't understand most of what they said because it was in all the, it was in Damara, in Erero, in Ovambo. They did in three or four languages, uh-huh. The different lectures and so on. And the only one I could understand a bit was Afrikaans. But I went, if I was in the Caribbean over the weekend, I went to the church first because I wanted to go myself, but also just to be with people and hear them singing.
And that's where they really got together.
That's where, but not the white and the black together.
Yeah.
It was very difficult. We had a farewell party in our office there. We invited everybody before leaving. So there you had, the black and white together. And it was in March, before we left. But apart from that, we were trying to be very natural, and then when there were possibilities to bring the people together, but very often I felt like a wall, you see, that of years of separation.
Mm-hmm.
And that was one of the most difficult things I found in the...
Did you leave with any hope that that was going to change?
Yes, I had some hope. I still have. I went 4 years later to Namibia.
Oh, you did?
Yes, when I was in South Africa, before leaving the mission in South Africa, I went back. So it was 1994. So 4 years after, there was not much change in that respect. Huh? Okay, there's a change because the government is black, and then, you have There's not much complaint about the, you know, people find it peaceful, they seem to be happy on both sides. Economic situation is difficult like everybody everywhere else. But this division is still there. And I think it will take a long time before it's completely changed, and that will depend on the economic situation, you know, possibility for everybody to go to school, university, and there were some changes already when we left. I could see in a year certain things having changed. I think mostly because of the, or to a large extent, because of the return of the refugees.
Mm-hmm. Did you find any degree of sophistication at all about the United Nations, about why the United Nations was there among the local population? Did they understand what you were there to do?
At first, not very much, because they've been so cut off from everything in the UN, had never been really there. So they had very limited knowledge of the UN. We did, you know, we tried to do some type of education, if I can say, information. And I think it did help, but it was difficult for them to understand what, you know, what the UN was, this organization. It's clear that maybe people of the SWAPO were more sophisticated. I mean, I'm talking about the leadership.
Right.
About that, because the fact that the UN had supported SWAPO, some of these people also had been abroad. I'm thinking of these two pastors in Ojibwe. They had been abroad for meetings because they are in the Lutheran church and so on. So you could find among the leadership of SWAPO, even people who had never left Namibia, but there was some type of information, you know, coming down. But for the rest, it was the other parties, clearly that was the organization that was coming here, supported SWAPO, you know, a long time, and then they were here to make sure that SWAPO would win the election.
And were the whites aware that the UN General Assembly had declared that SWAPO was the legitimate representative of it?
Oh yeah, many of the whites, especially those who were also in the leadership, the mayor of the town and several people, they knew that.
They knew that.
Yeah, that's why they were so really careful at first, and even aggressive against us. Some of the farmers had said that if these people come on my land, I'm going to shoot them.
Uh-huh.
So they better not come on my territory, uh-huh, you know, without asking permission.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
So we had been told, you know, to be careful. And the first time we went to a farm, I remember the attitude of the people. You see, they were, you know, the woman didn't even open the gate, you know, and then and then after that we became, you know, we had very good relations with them. They changed.
Now, I judge from what you said, you didn't really have security problems. The so-called coup was not there.
No, we didn't have. I don't remember any big incidents involving coups. There were constantly rumors.
Yeah.
That the Kufuts were here, that something had happened there, that you know, they were trying to do this and that, and it was mostly in the north. Huh?
Uh-huh.
Mostly in the north, where they had a lot of problem at the beginning, especially with the Kufut. But in our area, I don't remember specific incidents. Maybe police monitors would remember something well.
Right.
It seemed likely that the Kufuts were involved, but since we didn't have any big political problems, you see, and
you
violence,
not, yeah.
No.
Yeah.
But it's clear that in the north they were present and continued to do quite a lot of things, at least the first months.
Now, was there any movement of the refugees back into your area or not?
Yes, we had a whole group of refugees in Ojibwe, in that area, 60 kilometers from Karibib, where these two pastors were. So then they received their whole group of refugees.
Did that cause tensions in the society?
It did. It's a very poor community, and with you know, little information and education, some of them, there were two chiefs there, the Erewo chief, the Damara chief, we went to see them also, and then with the two pastors and these two chiefs, I mean, there were tension, and actually these returnees, naturally, we all perceive these are people coming here and they will vote for SWAPO.
Yeah.
And some people said they were Angolans, not. I mean, so there were all types of things. So there were tensions there. Yeah, and there was the time where I think the most tension. And I did the registration there, and actually all these people had these documents from High Commissioner for Refugees, and I was a little bit concerned that, this would create problem with my colleague, Mr. Gerbes, but it went. After that, the tension went down a bit, but in July, there was a lot of tension.
Was the High Commission for Refugees active in helping them to reintegrate into?
Yes, yes, they were, but I think most of the people who were there in Ujibini were not going to stay there.
Uh-huh.
Now, it was like temporary, they were not even from there, and it's so poor, there's nothing there in Ujibini. I mean, there's no industry, there's nothing. So it was really a temporary thing, and many of them left even before the election.
Yeah. Could you, just to give an idea, what was your typical...